think April, March 2016, and then another workshop on the 17th of October, where we met with the potential partners, and where there was also a ceremony of signing a pledge by those potential partners that was inclusive of government, sister department, including agencies like the DTI, for example, South African Maritime Safety Authority, a subsidiary of the Department of Transport, as well as the private companies, Woolworths, and others who also signed a pledge. So that is an ongoing exercise, but nearing the end of the rights allocation process, then we'd have to get commitment so that we now talk about partners, not potential partners. So that is, in a nutshell, the response with respect to training of small-scale fishermen. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
The total allowable cash shall be set aside for small-scale fisheries during the process of allocation of rights. There was also an issue of it's not on.
Yeah.
No, it's not lighting here. I think it is on there. There were also allegations that Umkhonto weSizwe were allocated some fishing rights. That's absolutely not correct. We have investigated that. Umkhonto weSizwe was involved in the around the discussion on security for them to get employment under an experienced security company. And the issue also that came was that employed professionals do get rights. Well, if it's a teacher or something, they will have to. There's nothing that says professionals cannot get rights. They do get rights. As somebody said, provided they declare. It depends on the police. And as well as reports on imported shrimp that was contaminated with cholera, that we do not know. We have investigated it. There is no substance to that. The interaction of DAF with law enforcement agencies continues to be there. There is a security and integrated security management document that the DAF has come up with together with the SAPS, and that is the one they are using to ensure effective security management of the coast. The investigation on allegations that there is a company that is harvesting abalone in the area of Clean Brag River. My information after asking this question was that Clean Brag River is actually a freshwater river. There can be no abalone to be harvested from there. And then the second one was the hunger strike by the Eastern Cape small fishers. The minister did go there, and there is no more hunger strike. There were some discussions. I was not privy to the content of that discussion, but there's no more hunger strikes of fishers in the Cape. Madam Chair, that is as far as the issues around fisheries are concerned, except just to update perhaps the Viking case. These are sub judice issues. Viking case is going to start sitting on the 6th of February. There is also a case around abalone sales that is also sub judice. There are problems within, we are filling up vacancies within fisheries, so really, by and large, I think the legal issues, we have taken note of the request to ensure that we don't manage through courts. We are going to communicate our strategy with all the fishermen. In fact, we are going to have a fisherman in Ndaba that involves all the stakeholders in fisheries. We will, and I will lead that, in articulating our vision, the government's vision, and emphasis on transformation and the role of other players in that. Transformation is not a threat. It is a necessary condition for South Africa to prosper and be peaceful. And that message is the message that I will carry forward and allow those guys, those colleagues on the other side to explain or articulate their own way of how they want us to deal with them. And then we both are going to come up with a document of how we are going to help one another going forward. The growth of small-scale fishermen is a function of their relationship with practical commercial farmers. I'm sorry, fisheries. Without that relationship, we all is going to be theoretical. Chair, that is as far as the fisheries is concerned, supplementary matters. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we will now take questions and comments if there are any. Questions and comments if there are any. It appears there is nothing, or Honourable
Thank you, Chairperson. DT, you said that because the military veterans are employed for security, but and that gives them access to be granted an allocation. Am I correct? Is that what you said? Okay.
DT, I hear you said there is a case with the sale of abalone, but that is sub judice. I understand that. The question I have is for the department itself and the issue around the sale of confiscated abalone in general. It is maybe we should get a report on that one day so that you can explain how that works. Is it an open market tender? Is it a fair price we get? Or is it just, sold to anybody that wants it? We need to make sure that that is so, and how much it is then, and where does that money, where is that money that is generated from that spent on specifically, or is it just go into a general fund and then it gets spent on everything else? Because I would think that if you confiscate abalone, and it comes out of the sea, you can obviously not put it back because it's dead already, then you would use that money to protect that source in a ring-fenced account more than what you would use it to pay somebody's salary or, you know, buy nice to haves. I would be able to make a case that then for it to happen. But if it's just for general funds, then I would not be able to defend something like that to say, well, you know, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, DG, you can now answer. But let me just caution you, DG. If a matter is sub judice, don't go into the details of that matter that is before the court of law. And this is also a caution to members. If we are told that a matter is sub judice and so on, let's not dwell into it. Let's allow the court processes to be completed. DG.
Thank you, Chair, for the guidance. First, let me just explain the issue of VET. VET, by nature, are people with an experience in things of security. Consequently, to try to minimize or obviate unemployment, we have made a decision that wherever there is a security contract in our seas, for example, would prefer to employ them under an experienced security company, or they may subcontract something like that, of course undergo training that is necessary. They do not have rights allocation on fishing at all. They help us in securing our small harbors, our fisheries coast. That's why they are helping us. We are encouraging that so that they can maximally use the experience they have, but though it comes as modified this time. And lastly, the sale of confiscated abalone is a process that we are investigating as in the past. It is our wish that it be used to effectively strengthen the security of the seas. That's where it belongs. We think so. But there are legislations in this country. We want to make sure that we do it in the context of those legislations. But it does not; it cannot be used to ensure that we function better. Otherwise, it's illicit trading. We do not encourage that.
Chair, I've handed back to you. There are two hands on my list. The hand of Honorable Maloy and Paulse.
Okay. Honorable Paulson and Maloy.
Okay, I'll go. Mine is just a follow-up question, Chairperson. Did you, I, I'm trying to understand what experience IMCA vets have. You know, I can understand you saying that we need to give them opportunities of work. I'm just trying to understand what kind of experience they had. They were never IMCA vets because they were given jobs as security based on experience. What sort of, did they go to war with anyone and win? Because the one soldier that ran away lost his arm. The rest were killed. So, what kind of experience? I mean, I wouldn't want to have my safety in the hands of an MK vet. Have you seen them?
You are out of order, Honorable Maloy. Honorable Maloy?
Chair, just two things. The first one is on the MK veterans. Was this a departmental program or a program of a service provider out there? And if it was a program of a service provider out there, as to what they do with who, it is not your business. Unless if it was your program. So if it's your program, we'll entertain it. But if it was not your program, please leave matters of MK, MVA, and whatever service providers to them, not to you. That's the first point. The second issue which I would want to raise, which would also be a comment, you know, on this thing of training, the answer we are getting is not quite helpful. Do you have a plan? If you don't have a plan, we are going to propose that you must have a plan. Your plan must be able to say, from this date to this date, we are allocating, from this time to this time, we'll be listening to appeals. From this time, we'll be interacting with people who will do this training. Then we are envisaging that at this period, till that period, training will begin. Have that plan, submit that plan, then we know that we work on the basis of a plan. Not that, you know, at some date we met with who we think that we'll... No, no. Let's have a plan. Let's just be a government department that has got a plan that is supposed to implement certain things, and there are specific timelines on those things. Thanks, Chair.
I think the issue of AKM, MKVets, I think Honorable Paulson did answer that. All I can say is that MKVets are, by definition, people who have been involved in security-related issues, and we have a strong confidence in who they are. All we do is adapt the training to fit the new circumstances, and they are better placed to change. As to they were doing that, really is both honorable Poloi. At one point, we also require that they do departmental stuff such as manning the small harbors. It is incumbent upon us, especially me as the leader, to ensure that they do get employment. And to that effect, we do that companies outside would then subcontract or work with them and train them to do the job. And that has been going pretty much well. And as far as I think we take the comment on training plan, remember in 2013 there was the finalization of the small-scale fisheries policy implementation plan. It is there. I think what we are saying, though, is that can you concretize that so that it can be measurable? And we are taking that comment, and my colleagues are listening. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think what we must do, in terms of the plan, the Human Resource Development Plan, actually is required by... the Department of Labor as annual. You submit it to where? Department of Labor or PSA? Yes. So and then it will then it's that plan and the plan for your stakeholders, which make your departmental plan. So that's the plan that Mr. Maloi is talking about. I just wanted to clarify that. So can we then... The issue of MK veterans, as you give an answer, DG, you are talking about them given by... They be given by service provider job. Why can't you give them direct? Because the majority of them have been trained properly. For me,
okay,
that those APWP programs are supposed to employ those people and use them to monitor our team. So you then give, and they don't qualify to get a contract directly from yourself. They must come through somebody else. You are suffocating them. You are not empowering them.
So we thank you for that, and maybe I made it sound like a generalization. I think the first one is a gradualist plan. It tends to evolve depending on who those MK vets are. There are instances where you have got fully fledged companies that have been formed by them. We do employ them, and I just need to have an audit of exactly where and how. But we do not necessarily have a policy that says they will be subcontracted. We don't have that policy.
So the outstanding matters from... Thank you, Fisher, for the input. So members, we are passing to the agriculture. So can you respond to all of them? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 points that were outstanding. So they must provide an explanation on the induction and training of the business continuity coordinating team, which was supposed to be done by the service provider at the cost of 75,240, but could not be done due to the lack of funding. This was reported in Department 2015 annual report. Provide clarity on the number of smallholder producers that have been supported for production efficiencies and those that were developed for access to market as stipulated in MT medium-term strategic framework. Report on the collaboration between DAF and the rural development on the alignment of Latter Animals and Field Management Program to DAF's Land Care Program. Progress report on PIDELFO. Progress report on deregistration of NGCHA. The organogram of department that has been outstanding for quite some time, progress on finalization of mechanization policy and the integrated funding model and comprehensive support for smallholder farmers, and the CADA program, how far are we in implementing that? Those are the outstanding issues.
Again, I'll try to move fast. I have summarized the issues. If there are details needed, the presenters will do the detailed presentation. But just to remind the chair about the apology I made for some outstanding issues that have not been dealt, that we still need to deal with. One of them is the issue of boreholes, the certification of those boreholes, where they are and what they do. That has been asked several times. The provinces have given us some information. We're validating that information. We will report in the next sitting of the portfolio committee. That applies to the drought-resistant maize, that cultivar, specifically in terms of where it has been utilized and how much of it has been utilized and how much of it is still in the stores. I will start with the business continuity coordinating team. The issue, the induction and training, which is the intervention we have done on that issue, with the business continuity management committee here in called BWCT, was conducted on the 9th of December 2016, with the assistance of a provider at a cost of 75,240 rand. It is led at DDG level and comprises of other selected senior management members of DAF. So as it was not budgeted, we then got the budget in and we went through it. The second point was clarity on smallholder farmers who were supported. We have a target of the MTSF targets of 80,000 smallholder farmers to be supported by 2019. It's very important that we note the years through you, Madam Chair, because without those years, the numbers begin not to make sense. The MTSF targets of 80,000 smallholder to be supported by 2019, and we broke them at 16,000 smallholders per annum, and the new growth path was speaking to a target of 300,000 smallholder farmers by 2020. Therefore, the initial target of 250,000 smallholders were supported in the year, or were supported by 2013-14 financial year out of outcome 7. We achieved that 250 for those two financial years out of outcome 7. The addition of 50,000 smallholder farmers to the 200,000 baseline led to a new target of 250,000. The 2020 target then will be reached when we add that to a total of 287,000 on a baseline of 200,000. So where we are sitting at 287,000 on a target of 300,000 of the new growth path. Those farmers have been supported, and we continue ensuring that they continue receiving support to grow. Madam Chair, you will excuse me, you may find out that my list is not chronologically, it doesn't follow a certain chronology. I will just lead, for example, now I'll just be talking with the, on the DAF and Dr. DLR on the alignment of land care, animal and felt management program. In reality, Madam Chair, these programs, we have made a collaborative effort that was facilitated by Department of Treasury, wherein we look at duplications. It is very clear at this point that these are going to collapse into one to avoid those duplications. We are working together with the Department of Rural Development. We have come up with some forums, but we have made a recommendation to the minister for these two programs to be collapsed into one program under the Department of Agriculture because of some duplications that were occurring there. I will just quickly ask my colleague to move as fast as he can on PDALF, Dr. Rampedi. I don't just want to read this and it doesn't make sense. I want to understand it. So you expect when it's going to go ahead, just on give us progress on PDALF. The bill itself, I know that Madam Chair has been working hard in trying to understand where this bill is. And we kept on saying it is with NEDLAC. I don't think the Portfolio Committee was impressed with that. And I did share that with you guys. So can you take a lead on this one, Doctor? When you finish, I will continue. Dr. Rampage.
Thank you very much, Director General. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and honorable members. I will be presenting progress report on the preservation and development of the agricultural land framework. Can you take mic to talk to the mic? Thank you. Should I? Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, honorable members. And thank you, Director General. My name is Mushibudi Rampedi. I am responsible for forestry and natural resources management. I will be presenting the progress report on the preservation and development of the Agricultural Land Framework Bill. In the past, there were presentations that were made to the Portfolio Committee, and as indicated by the Director General, for today we have to present progress on the matter. What is of interest at hand for the Portfolio Committee, and as pointed out in the past, was the slow progress, as was reported by the department, and the major concerns were raised with the department. For today, we are pleased to report to the Portfolio Committee that we have completed the process of the public consultations. The workshops were held in the 9 provinces, starting from the 15th of September to October 2016. For today, the policy is and the bill are waiting for a socio-economic impact assessment, which will be done by the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. The second issue that we wish to raise with the Portfolio Committee is that the bill is also waiting for pre-certification by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. And as expected, Madam Chair and honorable members, the department did present the bill to NEDLAC. For the record, the presentation to NEDLAC was done in July 2016 for purposes of introduction of the bill. And leaving the process to NEDLAC, there has been internal consultation within the structures of NEDLAC. And on the 18th of January this year, 2017, there was a meeting where we were able to discuss the bill with NEDLAC. What is expected going forward is that NEDLAC expects to continue with consultations. There are 2 meetings that are planned. The first one will be on the 2nd of March. The second one will be on the 10th of April. It appears as if there are some substantive issues that are being raised by NEDLAC structures, such as the implications of the bill when it comes to taxation and related matters. And there is also an observation that as the bill goes through, it will structurally really, really affect honorable members, the manner in which subdivision of land has been done in the past, and it will also have an impact on the decisions that are made by the 3 spheres of government. Assuming that the NEDLAC processes will go as planned, Madam Chair, we expect that at least by the end of April this year, we should be able to present the bill for consideration for cabinet processes. And if all goes well, we hope that by the end of July this year, we will be able to bring the bill for parliamentary processes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Rampedi. I will talk to the acts on the establishment of entities. The purpose of this particular a presentation is to provide the portfolio committee with a legislative program which will be followed to review legislation relating to the establishment of state-owned entities within DAF. The issue here, the founding legislation relating to state-owned entities require revision-based alignment with the Constitution, based on alignment with the Constitution, following the transformation agenda of government and supporting government outcomes and priorities.
You want me to go to the next? Okay, maybe I can. I am on X. I included some X that will on the establishment of entities and the review of most of those entities. I don't know whether that, I think it should be part of that. But it is an internal job that we are doing to review the ARC Act, OBP Act, the PPB, PPECB Act, NAMAC Act, Marine Living Resource Act, to see alignment and impact. I'm not sure if that's something perhaps was part of the list, but we were, as I was working, I felt it important that I do so. But in the, for the sake of time, I can go to Naga Farms, because I think that's an outstanding issue that is of significance to the portfolio committee. I'm sorry that I diverted a little bit. The Naga Farms, the report on Naga Farms is a PTY LTD. We just want to update the portfolio committee. The portfolio committee resolved that the Naga Training Institute has to be transferred to the Agricultural Research Council as a matter of urgency. Furthermore, based on the 2015-16 financial year annual report, the portfolio committee noted that the salary of the CEO of the ARC had been raised by 51% over a period of time. CEO of NAMAC. NAMAC, I'm sorry. Why are you giving me comments about that?
We're talking about NAMAC.
That was just a misspelled check. Well, the intervention that has occurred, Madam Chair, since that request has been the National Treasury on the 3rd of May 2016 gave in principle approval for the deregistration of NAGA. The deregistration is awaiting the signing of an MOU between DAF and ARC. The MOU is to be signed before end of February, and final deregistration is expected to be finalized by May 2017. Investigation on the salary increase has been conducted by the Directorate Employee Relations in DAF. Final report will, with recommendations on corrective measures to ensure that this okay will be, I'm expecting it by the 10th of February. From there, it will be presented to the Portfolio Committee in its next sitting. That was NAGA. You also requested me, Chair, to look at the organogram of DAF. We have got that organogram, and the details of it are here. We have actually included a comprehensive post-establishment component, which includes ministry and highlights all the posts and levels of the post within the establishment in DAF. So it goes deep and look at the profile with specific reference to the implementation of PE and I'm sorry, affirmative action where necessary. It is in the pack, so we are not presenting. It is a huge document, Madam Chair. Comprehensive producer support policy. Purpose of these policies to appraise the portfolio committee on the current development regarding the comprehensive producer support policy. The issues here is inequality to access and ownership of resources within DAF, especially the value chain in DAF, low productivity within the agricultural, forest, and fisheries sectors,
unsustainability of the sectors with specific reference to vulnerability to climate change that has been visible. Uncoordinated producer support systems. The interventions are the following. Draft 3 version 2 of the policy has been produced post Operation Pagisa. Draft 4 is to be concluded in March 2017, and consultation will continue within the cluster system will continue until July 2017. The integrated funding model, we are still working on this because we would have loved to update the portfolio committee on the full benefits of this model. If I can just talk to the issues, the previous political dispensation provided comprehensive financial support to white commercial farmers through land bank and provided seasonal loans through network of agricultural cooperatives. Commercial banks provided credit with land as a collateral, and agricultural credit board provided finance to small white farmers who did not qualify for loans from the land bank. The need, therefore, to craft new funding models for the new political dispensation is not only a necessity, it is a priority if we are to ensure that smallholder farmers grow and receive the necessary financial support from government. The interventions so far deal with the international best practices of funding mechanisms. We look at that. We continue with current approach option. We have a blended fund option, a separate fund option, integrate finance and farmer support service option with a strong emphasis on farmer initiative, self-initiative, public-private partnerships options, financial intermediaries options. We have, I have commissioned our finance chief to ensure that they come up with a policy that is blended, with an emphasis on ensuring that the farmers take accountability of increasing their productivity. So this one, we will be bringing it back, Madam Chair, once it has been finalized. I think we'll bring it back soon after in the next portfolio committee sitting. The mechanization policy. We have not developed a strong mechanization policy as a government. As a consequence, in agriculture, we have wasted huge amounts of money. These policies and procedures that we implemented have not had an effect. We bought tractors. Provinces are directly responsible for mechanization. The cost for managing the system was R700 to R600 per hectare, using 2013 as a base year, while the private sector costs were pegged at 4,700 to 6,000 during the same period. Now we have brought a policy document. The mechanization policy has been drafted and we are now compiling it for tabling. The policy has been presented to the House of Traditional Leaders and we have considered their inputs also. The policy has been consulted with all provincial departments of agriculture. Inventory of the tractors in the provinces has been taken. Costing of the limited state-run mechanization support has been done, estimated at least at a cost of $3 billion per annum. Again, it speaks to lack of coordination, lack of monitoring. We are therefore going to come with a mechanization policy that talks to accountability and ensuring that these trackers do efficient productivity. The CADAF, that would be the last one, last but not least. We would like to provide feedback on the challenges relating to the CADAF investment plan. The 2003 Maputo Declaration and the 2014 Malabo Declaration emphasize the importance of national set aside of 10% at the maximum of African states' budget towards improving the contribution of agriculture to the national economic growth of these states. However, in South Africa, there is a contestation on the importance of agriculture to economic development, as captured in the National Development Plan and the Theory of Development, where it is argued that the contribution of agriculture decreases as the economy grows and diversifies. The Qatar Investment Plan has been approved by the DGs in the IT, in the ICTs cluster. The plan was sent back from the ASET cluster. DG to DG discussion has occurred, especially between Treasury and myself, and we are about to come with a solid plan to unify our views. At this stage, we're talking different languages. At least what we were requesting here, Madam Chair, is that much as the national set target of set aside is 10%, we need to start somewhere. And up to now, we have not made great progress. Now, Madam Chair, there is a full presentation that is going to be done by ARC and NAMAC on hemp, government-funded research on hemp. It is my hope that they will be short in presenting it. Can you call it down, ARC? And I'm sure you heard that there is no time, there's not much time. You're supporting, you know, we are on the hemp research of the ARC. Is that this one? Would you be comfortable to use this one? Can you come and assist me? That's what you have. You want to do your own. If you have got, okay. It is yours. That the members can use what is in their specs.
Good afternoon, Chairperson, and good afternoon, Honourable Members, DG and colleagues. Good afternoon to yourselves. The ARC will present a progress update on the past and ongoing and future research on hemp. The presentation has been circulated earlier. We just included one new slide on introduction, which was to just capture the objectives of our presentation onto that slide. We were requested to speak to 4 points: the role of our organization, as well as the other stakeholders in this particular area of work, the major research results to date, and the challenges experienced in the execution of the current research and future areas of research to be undertaken to support sustainable hemp production in South Africa. in terms of the role of the ARC, if you could refer to the presentation that was circulated, we have captured the mandate of the ARC as that of a research and development organization whose research is intended to also ensure that there's transfer of technology to smallholder farmers. To ensure that there is transfer of technology to smallholder farmers. So we have summarized it in that slide, and it's a common slide. All of those activities of R&D, innovation, and technology transfer are undertaken to ensure that the ARC, like all organizations that are publicly funded, appropriately respond to the national imperatives of the National Development Plan, the growth path, and all the priorities as listed, but also to specifically ensure that we respond to the outcomes of government and other priorities as listed over there. We also have tried to consolidate all of these large responsibilities on our organization into specific strategic goals for the ARC as outlined. And the first goal speaks to the work that we do on crop-based agriculture. Second one, animal, livestock, and wildlife-based agriculture and their products and other beneficiated output. We are also compelled to ensure that we do conservation of natural resources and that our technologies do not pose any threat to the natural environment. We provide support and technologies for food safety and quality, and we transfer our research output to benefit smallholder farmers and the agricultural sector as at large. And in terms of corporate management, we have to adhere to governance and good resource management programs and processes. We are a science council similar to the other science councils in the country, but our main responsibility is to drive agricultural development. So the strict science and innovation solutions that we provide are based on scientific imperatives like other science councils, but with a much stronger focus on ensuring that the agricultural economy is supported by cutting-edge science, and we should become competitive using our scientific capabilities. As a result, we have then got 8 specific programs almost aligned to the goals, but with a little bit more detail. So hemp production is primarily, or the research in hemp production in the ARC is primarily within Program 1, which is crop production improvement and protection. But to ensure that we are able to transfer this technology to smallholder farmers, we also apply imperatives of the support of Program 6, which is smallholder agricultural development and extension and all of that, and to ensure that at a later stage we're able to make an assessment on the impact of our research output, we also apply agricultural economics. And the very highly awaited for commercialization of hemp would be also driven within Program 7, which still has not happened. We have the research output and results, but the commercialization is dependent on the progress report that will be given by NMAC on the feasibility study and other support that must come from other role players. The initial hemp research in the ARC started about 20 years ago, and at the time South Africa did not have any viable cultivars, so it was on the agronomic assessment of imported cultivars. 3 cultivars were brought into the country as listed: Compoti, Nova, and Futura, and we found that hemp is very sensitive to day length, and it for fiber production it does well in the areas of the country with longer day length. So this being the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape, but we also do a lot of hemp work at our Institute for Industrial Research at Rustenburg. The ARC has several campuses across the country, and the specific campus that focuses on industrial crops and products is based at Rustenburg at the IIC. So in there we do glasshouse production and research, because we're able to control the light hours. Otherwise, if we have to grow hemp for other uses apart from fiber, the bushy type, it can be produced in other parts of the country where daylight is not a problem. So eventually, the ARC has been able to come up with two cultivars of hemp, which have not yet been registered for purposes of controlling public access to this particular substance, which is psychotic in nature. And our other research, in addition to the development of cultivars, has been to look for the benefit of hemp is that it has lower THC, tetrahydrocannabinol content, lower than marijuana, and we hope this is the element that can make it more amenable for medicinal use. And so we have been testing the THC content on the two ARC cultivars, and it has been found to be stable, less than 1%. And the future research then, okay, so I have outlined the output of the breeding research there, which is the two cultivars, SA Hemp 1 and SA Hemp 2. And in trying to fast-track the presentation, being sensitive to time, we obviously have to now test these cultivars for other uses of hemp apart from just fiber production, which has been confirmed from 7 years of research. So for seed production, to be able to multiply it and make the seed available to farmers outside of the priority areas of Eastern Cape and Western Cape, only for fiber production. Remember, Eastern Cape and Western Cape is suitable for if we want to grow hemp for fiber production. But for other uses, including seed multiplication, we can do research in other parts of the country. And we are doing trials for that as well, to ensure that we can do seed multiplication. ARC does research, and in the same way we produce cultivars of maize for drought tolerance, and then we had to find seed production companies that are small that can be trained to take up the commercial benefits of these drought tolerant seeds. We have to do the same with other crops where we require seed multiplication. So we still are doing research on seed production of our own cultivars, and we're also evaluating these cultivars for oil extraction from the very same seeds, and then for the medicinal use of hemp. There's also been a lot of support in terms of mentoring of smallholder farmers to be able to take the commercial production of hemp eventually when it gets registered. And so outside of Eastern Cape and Western Cape, there's been extensive work that has taken place in KZN. We're working with a private company called House of Hemp, and they also have got the licenses or the permits from Department of Health to work with the farmers. So even in our trials, we don't just plant those research trials without those permits from the Department of Health. And so this particular area of work of improving extension support for smallholder farmers, including participation of other provinces, is going to be a major part of our future research. And also we would like to see provincial departments of agriculture coming together with the support of DAV to continue to give much greater extension support to farmers, so that at the time when it is commercialized, farmers are ready to take up the opportunity. We think there's great potential in the country to grow hemp commercially. It's regrettable that, you know, South Africa probably joined other countries of the world at the time when this important crop was criminalized. We hope it will be decriminalized because the benefits far outweigh the fears of what it can, what the product can do on society. And well, there was also a workshop held by the Department of Science and Technology around the 23rd of November 2016, where they are trying to rally also other stakeholders together to see what can be done to ensure that a good case can be made for hemp. So ARC is not in it alone, but all of us await the finalization of the feasibility study to determine or to give a conclusive indication that it is feasible to produce it commercially. This is where we shall end. Thank you very much.
You think Jack and Cole presentation, which is just research study by NAMC, and that would be, they are just looking at hemp feasibility study. They will summarize that, and then we hand over to you, Chair.
Yeah, whilst we are busy with technology, just avoid the introductory part. Don't tell us who you are, what are your objectives, and so on. Get straight into the point. We have not changed the portfolio committee. We are still the same, the one we've been meeting with all these years. So we know that part.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Good afternoon, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, DG of DAV and colleagues. I'm caught in a dilemma here. I'm trying to think whether should I try to talk to what we have done or go slide by slide. And if I go slide by slide, I think it will take me a lot of time. Given an instruction, so I won't get into the introduction. My name is Bonani Nyodo from the National Agriculture Marketing Council. So the work I'm going to be presenting is the work we have done on the feasibility of hemp. And that's the outline of the presentation. And so if we look at hemp, and I'm finding myself having to talk about what has been said already, that it falls into the same family as marijuana, and it differs from dacha in that it has low levels of THC, whilst it has the high levels of CBD. It grows taller than dacha, a herbaceous annual plant that grows to the height of 5 meters, usually single and slender stem. Regarded as an agricultural commodity in most countries and produced in over 40 countries worldwide. And the involvement of the NAMC was through the Hemp Foundation to look at the feasibility. Then in terms of the products and the market channels, is that industrial hemp is grown for three purposes: for its stock, for seed and leaves. And collectively, this result in more than 25,000 different products within 9 niche sub-markets, which is agriculture and textile, recycling and automotive, furniture, food, nutrition and beverages, paper, construction and cosmetics. Then if one looks at one of the value chain of that hemp, and that excludes the leaves, you would see that from the plant, you would get into products like the paint, the fiber band, the oils, and if you look at that, as I've just said, is that you have the side of the seed and the side of the stock and the products that you'll get out of that value chain, and it excludes the leaves. Then in terms of textile, I've just thought that maybe one should share that you out of hemp stock you'll get yarn, textile where you get both ordinary and the technical products, and they are defined in that small message below, where you have an indication of clothing, handbags, linens, and shoes as ordinary, and for technical you have the twine, rope, and carpets, and netting. Then in terms of the paper, what one can do with the paper that comes from hemp is a number of uses, ranging from the booklets to the banknotes. That's a typical value chain that involves the paper for hemp. Then in terms of the oil, when it gets processed, you can get the cosmetics. And the interesting bit is that not far from the Baltimore prison, there's an outlet there that sells these products. And most of what they sell is imported. And when you get into Somerset on the oil side, you find a big factory that does the packaging. They import the oil in big containers, does the packaging, and it gets sold into the market. The fact that they import and sell gives an indication that there is a market within. Then these are other value chains that one would find out of this hemp. Mm-hmm. And there has been research that has been ongoing. But the potential of hemp for biofuel seems not to be feasible out of the study that was done. And I'm trying to move as fast as I can. Then what I've indicated there in terms of the products that hemp would compete with is the flaxseed wood is caught in synthetic products. So those are products if hemp is introduced and competes with them, and ideally, because of the introduction of this competition, there would be an impact in one way or the other on the prices of those if this product is introduced. And if there is a soup kitchen in Khayelitsha which we saw, where the wood was made, where the wall was made of this hemp stock that was combined with lime. It's in Khayelitsha, it's run by this hemporium. Then if one looks at the nutrients that you would find from hemp and you compare with some of these competing products, that's what we have indicated then. Those are the indications of countries that produce hemp in reasonable volumes: China, Japan, Australia, Canada, EU. And in South Africa, the indication is that it's not legal. And the question is this what we need? And in those countries, it's legal, with the exception of Japan, where leaves are excluded. And the indication of the hectareage in those countries. And what one would say is that in the last 20 years, various countries, mainly in developed nations, have legalized the production and processing of hemp for industrial use after recognizing that the distinction between hemp and marijuana in terms of the THC. And South Africa, this is the information we got from a publication from the Eastern Cape Provincial Legislature, that South Africa is faced with a choice of becoming a competitor in the race to seek economic advantage from hemp or to allow others to carve out their niche market, which is the market we have. That I've just realized that's that is a repetition. I apologize, that's a repetition. Okay. Then when we get into the industrial international organization coordinating investments in hemp production, you would find that in Canada there is a Canadian Hemp Trade Alliance. And what they do is indicated on the last column. But what is coming out very clear from this, with the exception of the last one, is that most of these institutions that coordinate the investment of hemp in these countries are mostly NGOs. And in the case of the last one, which is an investment company that coordinates this between South Africa, Britain, Canada, and a couple of these countries, it's an investment company. And if you look at the challenges, and I think I would outline them as I move, of what we have of the people who are actors in the industry, is they are very skeptical of each other. I need to be very honest, and you find that it is very difficult to even get information, financial information from them, because they are few, and if they give you that information, that's their business secrets. That's the argument. And we thought that maybe one would look at the leading exporters of this product, where you would find Netherlands, Germany, and interestingly, Mauritius and Egypt made it into the top 10 of the leading exporters, even though their shares of these exports in value terms were not big. Then if you look at the leading importers in Germany, Czech Republic, Spain, Belgium, Japan, Switzerland, Australia, France, and Italy. And in this list, there is no expression of an African country, and those are the shares they command. And this is very clear that the top two account for a bigger proportion of what was traded in 2013. So there is a concentration of importation into Czech Republic and Germany. Then we looked at that's a more disaggregated now, and I think maybe I should just move because there is not much change on that one. Then in terms of hemp in South Africa, the evolution was presented to some degree by the colleague from the ARC. South Africa decided to explore hemp production following a need for development alternatives. And South Africa has been on the trailing phase of hemp production with the indication is that there is one entity that has the license, and the other actors who are even involved in the trial exercise are to some degree indicating that even the deliveries of seed is not that fast. And the Department of Health issues the licenses and regulates production. Trials were initiated in 1994, I hope this is the correct one, in Rustenburg by the ARC, funded by the South African Bust Crop Consortium. The founders of that include the ARC Institute of Tobacco and Cotton Research, PGC Bison, and yes. Then in terms of the first findings by the SABCC, suggested that there was a need to develop higher yielding varieties, high fiber and lower TCH hemp cultivars. And this is the issue to make sure that the THC levels are stable for this hemp, And as was indicated, that the trials gave an indication that for fiber in the provinces like the Eastern Cape, that's where you would get this. And the yields, because if you have a low yield, even if it's high quality, in products like this one, where you have to move volumes, you may not make a lot of money. And issue of adaptability of the cultivars to be addressed. That's what has come out of the engagements. And the CSIR, we've seen that it has conducted a feasibility study during that period. And the IDC at one stage did a work on profiling the hemp value chain. And out of that, it was, for hemp to come out as economic viable, they had to make a number of assumptions. And even on what we have done, for it to get to where it should, there is a number of assumptions. Otherwise, the story is not that nice. Then, in 27, the Premier of the Eastern Cape called for the National Hemp Foundation, which is the phase two of the research where we got involved, so that that phase two to have two committees, actually. The one that was the public sector working group led by DAF and consisting of NAMC, IDC, was tasked with determining the feasibility of commercializing hemp and the legislative environment. And the private sector working group led by House of Hemp, consisting of ARC and the CSIR, which was tasked in conducting commercial trials to determine factors that will influence commercialization of hemp cultivation and processing in rural areas and establish whether the THC levels are stable. The work that was done by the working group 2 that was led by House of Hemp came to the conclusion that the THC levels in hemp are stable and it's not dangerous, and that it is below the 3%, which is considered to be a bit high for a drug content. The THC is this measure of a drug content of this product. So in DAHA it is much higher. In this one is lower and stable. Then in terms of the cultivar adaptation, 3 exotic cultivars are well developed and to the South African condition. And the ARC has come up with SA Hemp 1 and 2 and are at par or outperforming international competitors. That's the indication that has come from that side. But if you look at what the trials have achieved in terms of yields, is not what is in that statement. And in terms of emerging farmers, there are opportunities. That's what one can see. And in order for these farmers to make it, there would have to be a lot of training, and it is also possible to control community-based hemp trials with permits. And these permits, I must confess, in all the areas where we have gone, where these trials were, this issue of permit and the delivery of some of these things has always come out, and these farmers would have to be assisted in terms of resources. In terms of the possibilities, extraction of hemp in the processing, which would come with the issues of the medicinal part and the extraction of the seed. Then the challenges, the first one is the legislative and the regulatory constraints that hinder its viability. And, what we're made to understand is that it takes time before a permit is cleared and this affected the trials. And the trials were the trials which were conducted, in our view, having accessed their financials, is that they were not viable. And not because of many other things, but because of a number of issues. And the first one is the processes, which are bureaucratic. The second one is that there was an indication that the trial could not be done on more than 2 hectares. And the last one is that the varieties that were explored were few. And hemp, in this instance, and I'm sure I would outline other issues. Maybe let me get to this question, and I what I have there is a disclaimer that this information, we hoped that we'll get a complete financial information. And when we interacted with the industries, the actors, no one was willing to provide their information. And the skepticism they had was that one of their own, who is a competitor to them, is leading the side of the commercial working group, which is House of Hemp. And they said if they avail that information, even if they were to make us to sign confidentiality, they were not feeling that comfortable. And the information we have thereof is not as complete as what we wanted. So to check this feasibility, we used the information we got from the trials. And hemp production stands to provide employment, creation, and income. And we wanted to do all these things, but we ended up having to concentrate on what you would get out of a hectare of hemp production. And that's primary production. We have not moved up the value chain. And what one can say without taking much time is that we also looked at what others are doing, so that if what we have in terms of this enterprise budget for hemp, we get that information, we look at it, and we say it, what we should not do is to manipulate these figures, because they will haunt us one day. It's to put them, and they normally say garbage in, garbage out. What you get on this input side is what you should allow to move on the output side. And we used the information of both USA and Canada, so that whatever we're going to get, we compare it with those. And so for USA in Colorado, that's the typical enterprise budget. And the interesting bit is that these guys in their enterprise budgets, they're using acres and pounds, and we feel very comfortable using cages and hectares. So if you look at the information there, what we have, which one looks at how many acres would make 1 hectare, or how many hectares are equivalent to that 1 acre. So for 1 hectare, you would get about 0.405 acres. So what you have there is almost half of a hectare. And the in terms of the pound, that's the same interpretation because of the kg. So what we wanted to check is the outline of this enterprise budgets in terms of production costs and returns. So that's the information which is at the end a negative for this Colorado. And let me get into this second one. And on this one is a positive, but for the one we have done, which is ours, those are the trials, all of those hemp trials we have gone to, and we removed the names so that if one looks at it, you cannot easily identify which one is that. And what one would see is that the price of seed, the price of labor, and you look at the income, the cost of seed and the cost of labor are a bit high per hectare. And when you look at the income is low. And when we tried to look for the argument as to why would the income be that low, we got an indication that when these guys in these trials harvest, there is one buyer. So it's a monopsony kind of a setup where one buyer comes to collect this, and the colleagues here in the Cape were even complaining that it gets bought in Western Cape, moved to Gauteng for it to be processed, and they buy from Gauteng. So the market setup from the onset is that it's not competitive. So one wouldn't expect that the prices that would be paid for a ton of a produce would be competitive. That's the first argument. The second argument is that the seed seems to be high. And when we looked at all of this, and if you look at all of these trials, you'd see that these trials were running at a loss, and one would say that's not viable. So that's the income combined by years for all of them over the period. And what we said maybe we should do is to say, let's take the yields from those that have legalized it, and we say the varieties would have would produce up to those yields, and we check whether it would make any economic viability. And if you relax those, because now we are saying the regulatory framework is to some degree dictating as to how price formations are done. If you remove it and to impose the system of those who have legalized, that's only when the yields are increased that would lead to a bit of higher prices where you would get the this hemp to be viable. So it is under a number of conditions where one would see it. And the use of these trials, and when we looked at it from the onset, we said in the first place, the trials were not set with the aim of checking whether it is going to be viable or not. From the onset, to some degree, they were set to measure this TAC. So that was one of those things. And if you change, as I have just said, the situation changes, then in terms of the challenges, that's the permit process, the fencing requirements, which is supposed to be 2 meters or 1.5, the delay in the permit issue, limit of the size, insects and the weather, then the external, which is the bad soils and poor management and lack of self motivation, and so that's the information I spent a lot of time talking about without moving into it. Then what we also included here is this CBD, which is I don't want to say it's a byproduct. It's one of seemingly a substance that comes from the leaves, which is of high medicinal value, which if you put it as well, which would get into the argument that if one looks at the kind of varieties that would end up getting developed, if those varieties are offering a number of options in terms of how much of this CBD would be produced, a ton of this, that would get into a much positive picture. Some countries have legalized it, it's traded globally, and we trade in it. We could not get into a lot of information we wanted to because of availability of this information, and we had to make a number of assumptions. And the work, and a work of this nature would have to be determined to, in addition, a work of this nature would have to determine the viability of each of the nodes of the hemp value chain. But information availability limited what we could do, and those are some of the remarks. What we thought maybe one would put is that introduction or provision for use of different varieties need to be monitored and encouraged. Development of locally adapted seed for all uses need to be prioritized and be driven by business and not what researchers want to do. Because what you would get from these business guys, the argument is that they say the ARC has been involved in this work for some time. And what the colleagues in the ARC enjoy doing is to work with what they like working on, not to be driven by what they as businesses want. That's what we thought we should put. And the other one, which is D, which is the development of industry norms and standards which have to be prioritized. And we thought maybe one would say an effort would have to be done to make sure that these colleagues in this industry talk to each other, because they treat each other as serious enemies and are not willing to give information, because one would understand they are few. And if they are few and you are in this business and you have value information, someone may use it to counter what you are doing. And what we said is that this work and the indication is that some of them, the challenge with the industry is that the colleagues would talk and promise to give you information and you don't get to get that information. And those are the few conclusions, and thank you for the opportunity.
This on our side, Chair, we leave it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a marathon, yeah? Yeah? Hi. Can we then have honorable members if you want to engage on the maybe for us to move with speed and finish, we should follow one by one. We'll start with the can I allow members to ask questions? I need to on him. Yeah, him only. Or do you want to go into? I thought those ones did not finish when I'm gone.
No, we did not. We did not deal with those. It was just presentations. I thought that we will not get into those, because those are issues that were raised by the portfolio committee and we expected the department to respond. So they've given us their responses, but it's up to members if they want to engage further on those. My interest and the interest of Honorable Paulson is on hemp, marijuana, and so on.
I could see that already as it's on his head.
Before
you can, but I've not noted you. Wait. Honorable State. I'm distracted. Chair,
Yes, I want to thank the department then for this information. I think, you know, as we said last time, the proof is in the pudding. It's all good and well to come and bring us policies, but we will discuss all this wonderful stats and information that we got when we do the quarterly reports and annual reports. So we will read them with interest to take them into consideration when we discuss the rest of the department. I just want to ask one question on NECA. I didn't see anything about what is happening, or is it up to this portfolio, or do we write to another department to find out how can a person increase his salary by 51% just by himself and nothing happens, Chair? I want to try and find out how do we deal with that one specifically, because I think the deregistration is one thing, but a person giving himself a 51% raise is something that I'm not sure if it's up to this portfolio to deal with it, or what do we do about that one before we go to the MP issues.
Okay, so the department was supposed to give us a report, because you said they must look at it and tell us why did they allow a CEO to give himself a salary when they were supposed to deregister and increase it over 51%. 1%, which has never happened.
I think there was a major mistake. We are going to recover that. We have returned to the CEO, and the process is on. But we have got details, Madam Chair, in the package there. But we are on that already.
Thank you, DG. Honourable members, Honourable Chair, they are in your packs. They are reports in terms of the issues that we have raised. There are many presentations regarding this issue on the salary, investigation on the salary. We are awaiting the final report coming from our employee relations, but the steps in terms of being taken are there in terms of ensuring that the corrective actions are taken against the issue that was there. Thank you.
This thing, MTF targets, we're clarifying every now and then, but we still come still confused. There is outcome 4, which talks about job creation. And you were expected to produce, to 300,000 smallholder producers producing for the market by 2019. And the other outcome, which is outcome number 7, for food security, which says additional 80,000 smallholder producers receiving support to ensure production efficiencies by 2019. So every now and then when we ask this question, you come giving us one.
The question was to clear the target as in quantity and years, and then from there be clear as to what support has been given to those that we have already achieved in terms of supporting.
Yes, as you give, as your contribution should be the outcome 4.
Yes.
We're expected to support smallholder farmers. To support them to access market, 300,000 access market. The outcome number 7 is for food security. Additional 80,000 smallholders, producers receiving support for production efficiency by 2019. These are two different outcomes.
Yes.
think as time goes, you're thinking the planes. Somebody was disturbing me about it. As I'm saying, Madam Chair, unless I've missed you, the 300,000 up to 2019, those we have been giving them support in various ways through ILIMA and through CASP. And those have been identified in some provinces. They've been put into a farmer register, which we have encouraged so that we can know that the type farmer so-and-so of this growth doing this commodity has been supported with these inputs so that there can be no duplications in supporting that farmer. Now, the ones of 2020 in particular are the ones who are going to be supporting through the 30% set aside, which will allow us to access government markets. And those are the ones we are submitting for. I don't know if I'm missing you there.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think now, as Chair speaks, it becomes very clear in terms of where the misunderstanding comes. The 300,000 that Chair is referring to within Outcome 4, Sub-Outcome 5, and the other ones that we are talking about is Outcome 7, Sub-Outcome 4, and I think that we might just need to give clarity in terms of the two that are here, and the response that we have given while just talking about the numbers without clarifying the two areas of divergence in terms of outcome 4 and outcome 7. And we will then clarify that, I think, from a DG's perspective on this one.
What outcome
4?
Outcome 4 talks about job creation. So you then support these smallholder farmers for them to get the market to create jobs. So the outcome of that process, the job creation. And outcome 7, you support these smallholder farmers for production efficiency, which it will go to your 1 million hectares. You remember? So you'll go and look it and report it appropriately. Honourable members, any other things? We are fighting with even with him. Oh. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I want to also thank the presenters for the information. Chair, I'll start with the ARC because they were first. I just want to find out, on one of the slides they said they are in the final stage of evaluation to plant these two lines on a commercial scale. Then it says this is dependent on approval of legislation of hemp. Whose role is that to do the legislation? Will it come from a department? Will it come from a portfolio committee? Because we can't wait, I'm sure, for the legislation. It takes 2-3 years. We know how long it takes. Is there any draft legislation in place, or how does it work? And I'm sure it's not the role of the ARC, but I would like to find out maybe from the department or from the deputy minister sitting there, he might be interested also in legalizing the product. And then it says here in the same slide, finalization of the feasibility study under the auspices of DAF is a major dependency. So how far is the finalization of the feasibility study? When will we have a final product to say, or do I assume that when it says here on the next page, the ARC research has shown that hemp can be grown commercially in South Africa, that it now says that it can be done, or do we need to wait? It's two different processes. The one is the legislative side, which someone else will have to deal with, which I need to find out who is that someone else. And then the second part is the fact that the ARC or the department can now say that it can be grown commercially in South Africa successfully. So does the one wait for the other, or that, how does it work? Then, Chairperson, on the presentation by the National Agricultural Marketing Council, and I'm a bit concerned by the statement that the departments don't work with each other, and it's one of the things, Chair, that you've been trying to do successfully is that they talk to each other, because entities basically work under the auspices of the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, and that's why I think the Department of Agriculture needs to take the leading role in saying, you too, all of you, everyone deals with this, let's get together and see how far we are so that we can get to a point. It can't be 20 years later and we don't still know who's doing what where. Chair, outside of the hemp that can be produced for all kinds of other produce, I want to find out if there's medicinal trials that has taken place, because I could see there were monetary value towards that, but were any trials from that side done in South Africa or not, or are we working on international best practice? And then the National Agricultural Marketing Council said, however, some of the variable costs might not be necessarily incurred in the South African context. Do we know which cost that would be? And I know there was a document about all the price, but which specific costs are we talking about? And I think it was the ARC, one of them spoke about the two different varieties in the seeds. Did we grow our own seeds? I think it was the ARC on the trials. Is it the South African produced seed? Because there's some, when we talked about that two seeds, it said that we are actually the yield was better than in some of the other. So would it be a specific South African seed that produced for South African climate, or did we just start growing available seeds that's already there? And then lastly, Chair, would anyone be having access to this information? And it's this thing of the access to information and different people that want information. If you want to see these trials and people are interested in it, can we go somewhere to go and have a look, or can someone go to the to a website? I think there was mentioned made by the ARC on the Eastern Cape hemp trial thing, if we can go and have a look at it so that we can see how difficult it will be to grow in any other parts of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, just two questions. You know, your presentation is confusing. The other sentence says we are awaiting finalization on the feasibility study. The other sentence says CSIR concluded the feasibility study. Now, I'm not sure where are we. If we can be provided with some information, at what stage are we? Is the feasibility study concluded, or are we still waiting for the finalization of the feasibility study? That's the first one. The second question relates to the entity. You said one entity has license to produce. Which entity is that one? And on what basis is it producing? If this thing is still illegal in South Africa, and so on, what is the situation? What is
exactly happening? Because I'm getting confused. I'm getting confused by the day. The coordination with other departments, including stakeholders, you have also highlighted there that it is a problem. Who is the lead department? Because the lead department must coordinate. Is it DAF? Is it health? Or who is it exactly? In order for us to understand what's happening here. The House of Hemp, is it the one that you are referring to that they've got a permit? No, no, not a permit. That they've got what? A license. Are you referring to the House of Hemp? If so, who gave them the permit? Is it the Department of Health or is it yourselves? If we can get clarity. The last point which I want to highlight, why is it taking more than 20 years to do this exercise? Is it because of a financial constraint, or is it because there is no proper focus, and so on and so forth? So if we can enter into that. But at the later stage when we discuss, Chair, I want to speak about this coordination thing, because I think that is where the problem is. Everybody is doing research, there is no coordination, and everybody is presenting his own report and so on, as if we are different governments and so on, whilst this is one government, this is the South African government. There must be some coordination. Bring all these things together and so, and say, this is now the report, this is what we need to do going forward. But everybody is just reporting, we are ready, we are not ready, we are doing feasibility study, we are waiting for finalization. It's just a lot of confusion. I'm not sure what's happening here. Thanks, Chair.
I think the conclusion of NAMAC, it says economic feasibility study indicates that hemp can be visible, viable industry or not. The integrated interdepartmental team can consider using both the economic feasibility report and technical report from ARC, whatever, and others to make one final report, a submission proposed legal succession while exploring possible legislative amendments will be forwarded to all the key departments. Who's going to do those things? Who must do those things? So I have questions on issues of security. So, and they can't be responded by ARC and NAMAC. It must be security cluster which report on which respond on the issues of security. So can we propose the way forward in terms of taking the process forward? Because this information that comes in this integrated way, just is not helpful. And this thing, 20 years, if it was not actually, and it's here because we've asked question about it. If we didn't ask questions, it would not have been brought here. And 20 years, people are busy going up and down with this issue. So, can we agree on the proposed, I'll ask them to respond, and then members can, in the meantime, think how we should move this issue. Okay, ask your question. You know, Honorable Boss, you've been talking and I thought you finished. Because you've been talking, everybody, when others speak, you throw your own input. Continue.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would just like to know, since it's illegal for us to grow the stuff here and produce it here, but it's quite legal to import the products from overseas, and it's Tony Budden from Emporium, by the way, that has the 2 acres of hemp growing in Stellenbosch. So I'd just like to have a sense as to, do we know what the value of the imported materials, products are? Because I know even the boards are imported that were used to build the house in Noordhoek. It's completely from hemp materials. Wonderful feel. It's a living, breathing wall. So it's very healthy also. So we must have a sense as to what the value, and I mean, this is without much marketing of the product, or there hasn't been any marketing. There is really just people who felt that it was something good, and already there is such a demand for it. And everything hemp, I mean, even a 10 milliliter of hemp oil, it's in the region of 1200 rand. 10 milliliters, not a lot. It's like 2 teaspoons. And it's used to treat cancer patients. So, what's the value of these imported products that's coming onto our shores? Because it's money that's leaving this country, and you know, when money leaves this country, it's jobs that are leaving this country. And I think it's a good argument, and this is where we need to have this interdepartmental collaboration, DTI possibly, and to actually make sure that this industry takes off in this country, and that we actually get to grow our own hemp and create our own hemp industries and provide jobs. I know there's a lot of other stigma attached to it, and to hemp, I mean, but we're not talking about cannabis sativa here. No, it's a different product. Totally different. The one that you're referring to that you smoke, Chairperson, is the one that the Indians brought here on the boats, cannabis sativa. It's not the same thing. Thank you, Chairperson.
You want to propose way forward? I wanted to allow them to respond to those issues and then.
No, I want to respect your decision, Chair. The only concern I want to raise is that, you know, we can't sit in a portfolio committee meeting and discuss for the sake of discussing and waste a lot of time and so on. So I had wanted to suggest to you that instead of us allowing them to answer these questions and so on, we should not go there because it will not add any value to our work. But instead, we must say we must go back, meet with all these people who are doing this work. Then we must call them after they've consolidated, and they must give us a report, a comprehensive report, that take into consideration all the work that has been done. Then we can pose questions on that particular work. But for now, it's not going to help. It doesn't. It is not.
Agreed. Okay, thank you very much. Means that now DG DAF would have to lead. Because if you say ARC must lead, NAMAC will say I can't be called by ARC. So DAF must lead your entities and meet with other departments so that we are able to get a consolidated report and have a way forward on the issue. Agreed. So, in terms of the program, we are done for today. So the GM, you want to say something before I release your team?
No, thanks. Chairperson, I just want to take a step back to red line in restaurants. The decision that was taken by the department for new entries, especially those former disadvantaged people, was to cut on quotas that exist. And this discussion took place leading to December. The lobster was going to be cut by 34%, and which caused the outcry. And discussing until November, and in December came the red line. It has never been there, the red line. All the time, people fetching this thing, there was never a red line. Even when, you remember those tons and tons that were thrown out by the sea, there was never a red line. The red line comes from the understanding that the new entrants, the former disadvantaged, will come in the market. And this red line will be for your South African restaurants in Europe. Those that get big ones, they sell in Asia. There is no red line in Asia. There is no red line. So they will continue to trade in Asia, here causing this www, causing the red line here, which is happens to be some kind of the international NGO imposing on government what to do. So it does go to what we're saying, that is more politics rather than the economics. The granting of 34% will continue to the new entrants, and the people will work hard that their cash, those small ones, also find the way to the east, where there are no red lines. So the question was, where will they get the market? They will get the market where the big boys send theirs without the red line. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, I think it's clear, the issue of the red line. You know, one thing with South Africa is that there are a lot of things that have been governed outside the government or outside the constitution of the republic. There are a lot of structures that gave themselves powers to govern this country. You know, I was discussing with Minister of Water Affairs, raising issues of water, and he was saying, you know, I'm the Minister of Water without power, without that water. Water is somewhere with individuals in the country through the process of this AMA authority to, what is the boards and other things, and individuals owning Josini Dam. So you can't have such, how do you develop the country with such situation? So this chap who's owning Josini Dam, of course, you can decide that you can't put a pipe here on Josini Dam. So that is the challenge that we have in South Africa. And this thing must come to an end. It's including these things of whoever. Now the person can make a decision to impact on people and government. If a person put the red line on behalf of, I don't know, on behalf of business, for the community, the greater community or society, it's a problem. And at some point we said, DG, there is a lot of these agreements that you make and join other organizations, particularly on fisheries, that govern the fisheries. So at some point we might want to come and discuss, just to check their impact to our own government in terms of development. Because tomorrow we'll be told, no, the small fishery people cannot be included because Council of what Wadina in Japan says they cannot come in. I'm told there is one fish that you have to use the different and a particular ship to catch it. So you could see that makara, yeah, something like that. Then we don't even have a ship in South Africa. You have to loan yourself. It's only one company that has that ship. So you see that we're in trouble in South Africa. I think officials must help us to develop and develop South Africa such that the people of South Africa in the process will participate in their development and determine their destination. So not ourselves deciding for them. We must make them to participate for them to determine their own decision. All of us deployed in various corners, we are the deployees just to lead those people towards that. So I think that's one of the things that we have to work to achieve. And thank you very much, DM and your team. It was a good meeting, I hope, DG. Thank you very much. You are released. Members, you can stay for some few minutes. And I'm told there is tea there. You can have a cup of tea as you go.
That's going to cost us 3 minutes, so I talk 10 minutes.
Paul has just gone out, then we'll try to call him and just left. You see, I think we you must actually talk to the whip of other parties, because if now we're seven, now we can't form a quorum to adopt the minutes. So I think we just have to take ourselves seriously.
Chair, can I propose that the next meeting we actually start, but I can't even say start earlier because some people only come halfway through the meeting. Because if we could have started halfway before a meeting. No, forget that proposal.
No, but I think the whip has to. Because one of the things is that we have to have the quorum, and before any member leaves the meeting.